Hey, it's Bill Simmons. I wanted to tell you about the launch of our new YouTube channel. It's called Ringer Movies. You can follow us right now on YouTube at Ringer Movies to get full video episodes of the rewatchables and the big picture, plus a lot of our archives with much more coming soon. To celebrate the launch, we're going live on Monday, May 13th at noon Pacific with our first ever live rewatchables with me and Sean Fennessy and Chris Ryan and Van Lathan. Follow Ringer Movies on YouTube so you don't miss it. YouTube.com/Ringer Movies.
This episode of The Town is brought to you by FX's Feud, Capote versus the Swans. The second installment in Ryan Murphy's Feud anthology tells the story of acclaimed writer Truman Capote, once a confidant to society's most elite women, whom he nicknamed the Swans. Starring Naomi Watts, Diane Lane, Chloe Sevigny, Calista Flockhart, Demi Moore, Molly Ringwald, and Tom Hollander. For your Emmy consideration, visit fxnetworks.com/FYC. This episode is brought to you by Max, presenting the HBO original True Detective. When the long winter night falls in Ennis, Alaska, the eight men who operate the Tsalal Arctic Research Station vanish without a trace. To solve the case, Detectives Liz Danvers and Evangeline Navarro will have to confront the darkness they carry in themselves and dig into the haunted truths that lie buried under the eternal ice. Don't miss the series BBC calls fierce and absorbing, eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. It is Thursday, May 9th. When I say the words Hollywood producer, you probably get an image in your head. Rich guy, sunglasses, driving a fancy convertible to a movie set, probably talking loudly on his phone. But that stereotype often doesn't match the reality for modern producers. The truth is, the non-writing producer is kind of an endangered species in Hollywood these days. Studios used to carry dozens of producers, give them lucrative deals to develop projects and acquire material that they then have the right to turn into movies. In TV, the non-writing executive producer was out hunting constantly for the next big idea or spec script to turn into a hit show. There was real value there for these curators. You can make a great living and hit the jackpot if you developed a franchise or a big show. But slowly over the past 15 years, those deals have evaporated. Studios, especially the streamers, see way less value in producers unless they also write or act or direct. And if there's a budget issue on a project, the producer is almost always the first to be asked to cut their fee. For most producers, you kind of got to raise your own money to get a studio interested in you, which of course limits the kind of people who can do that job. But producing is a skill and a talent, I'd argue. And there's a group who are pushing for producers to be treated more like the other people with skill and talent in the industry. Hollywood is heavily unionized, of course. Actors, writers, directors, gaffers, the guy who drives the stars around in a golf cart. They're all protected by unions. There's a producer's guild, but it's not a guild, really, not a union. It's mostly there to resolve credit issues, and it puts on an award show every year. But this new push is called Producers United. It's a group of about almost 100 what they call career producers. They want healthcare paid by the studios. They want a change in how fees are doled out. Some other protections. They say it's crucial for the continued existence of the profession. And they've got some big names associated with this push, two of whom are here today. Lorenzo de Bonaventura is the former president of Warner Brothers. He's long been one of the most successful producers in town. He made Transformers, G.I. Joe, the Meg franchise. Kathy Schulman, she has a Best Picture Oscar for producing Crash. She's currently the CEO of Well Entertainment and a producer of The Idea of You, the new Anne Hathaway movie on Amazon. So today it's producers, what they actually do, why their pay is so squeezed, whether the profession can continue to exist in Hollywood, and how it impacts the movies and TV that you and I see. From The Ringer and Puck, I'm Matt Bellany, and this is The Town. All right, we are here with Lorenzo de Bonaventura and Kathy Schulman, two very accomplished producers. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so I want to get into this push that you guys are involved in for better conditions and greater rights for producers. But I think we need to first just go into a little bit about how producers make money, because I don't know that everybody realizes what goes on. People have this image of Hollywood producers. Give me a little bit of background on how producers have traditionally made money and how things have changed in, let's say, the past 10 years.
It's changed quite a bit because I think fundamentally producers had the opportunity to play for a bigger upside 10 years ago.
Right.
And I think if the notion is producers make so much money, that may have been true 10 years ago, although I think it's always been exaggerated. It's been a select few that really get to that place, and it takes a long time to get to that place. But now, given how studios and streamers and all the buyers treat the back end, it's a very rare thing to get that pot of gold, if you would, at the end of the rainbow. And so the way producers make money is really a fee-based situation. And there has been traditionally something called a development fee, which has been in 1971 established at $25,000 and has not changed since then.
So you get the development fee up front when you sell a project to a studio, and they say, great, go off and turn this into something. And the producer goes out, try to attach talent, try to get a script in condition that a studio would say yes to it. And throughout that process, the writers likely will be paid incrementally because their guild requires that. And yet the producer on that project does not get any money. And these development processes can last years.
And they can last 19 years.
Yeah, I think I had one for 13. I mean, I would even back up to say that, you know, you mentioned that we sell a project to a studio. I mean, the reality is we do something that they call set up a project, which pretty much means you transfer your rights and then you start working for them. And usually you've put a lot of investment of time and sometimes money into whatever it took to make the project interesting in the first place before you begin the process where you're not being paid.
Yeah. And right. I also, to be clear, they give you $12,500, not $25,000. And you only get that when either they make it or they abandon it. So you could be that 12 and a half has to sustain whoever that producer is for as long as that run occurs.
And the way that the streaming economy has evolved, I mean, there are now producer pools on projects where all the producers, including people like you who call yourselves career producers, we'll get into what that means, versus, you know, the actor's manager and the person who represented the actor who used to be on the project, but they remained as a producer. All the producers kind of are put into a pool, which reduces the fees that people get. And then when there are inevitably budget issues, it's typically the producers who they go to and say, listen, to get this over the finish line, we need you to cut your fee because we can't go to the guild protected actor, writer, director to do that.
Yes, they go to the person who has been spending the most amount of time trying desperately to get this thing made, who actually, you know, in many ways, I think one of the calling cards of being a good producer is you care first about the movie and second about yourself. Honestly, and so that is what happens a lot of time is producers do end up reducing and reducing and reducing. And one of the interesting aspects of being together is, you know, 90 producers now have gathered together, is you hear all the different stories, you know, and one that really affected me was a younger woman, and she can tell her own story, but the short version is she was paid $30,000 for 2 years of work while the movie was getting made and then nothing beforehand. So that's not a living wage in Hollywood, that's for sure.
Right. Okay. So this notion of the high-flying producer, and to be clear, you two are doing fine. This is not about you in particular. You guys are some of the more successful examples of producers. And there is a class of producer, I was looking at the list of people that are involved in this, that doesn't need this and is not going to suffer if this doesn't happen. You guys say that you are advocating for the producers to come, or the guy, let's say, you know, Craig decides to be a producer, and even going into that profession is almost impossible these days. I mean, the list of active and legitimate producers under 35 these days is tiny. I mean, I barely even know any of them. And I think these economics do play a role. You sort of have to be independently wealthy or bring your own money to the table through financiers or, you know, be somebody's kid in order to be a producer, as a producer, not as a manager who produces, not as someone who is like kissed in as a favor, I'm talking about a working producer. It's very difficult if you are not established or come from some studio job where, you know, part of your exit deal is they have to make you a producer for 5 years and pay you, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when we came up in the business, there was an infrastructure, and it really had to do with the fact that the studios saw producers as their partners, and we had, there were overhead deals, and we learned from the great, great, you know, mega producers before us. We all had the benefit of that sort of time, that apprenticeship, while they had enough economics to have some infrastructure. We don't have that anymore. Studio deals have been cut back extremely as it regards for producers, and the trend is to give them really to actors right now. And what's happened as a result is there's no training ground, you know, for producers coming up for us to learn, to teach them. And then on top of it, with this economic pressure that you said, you're absolutely right when you say that the amount of producers that are getting pushed out before they even get a foothold is so extreme. And really the reason why we, you know, created this collective that we're calling Producers United was that as we got together as more senior people, we realized that we had a calling to this leadership. Like, we really have to do something about this because there's no way forward. And unless the studios and streamers want to take a position that producers are completely irrelevant, we better do something to protect them.
Well, they may do that. I hear it all the time that, you know, we want this project to be as lean as possible. Yes. We're going to deal directly with the talent. We are not going to have, you know, the bloated producers on it. They are sort of openly, I mean, depends on the different company, but a lot of them are openly hostile to producers. Why has that changed? Because you could make the argument here, and I think a lot of people listening to this might say, isn't this just a market issue? If producers were showing their value to studios, they would be getting paid. And if they're not showing their value and the industry is evolving away from the non-writing producer as a career path, then that's just the way the studio business is evolving.
As someone who ran a studio and has been a producer, you know, several of the people on our list have run studios in our different things. And all of us came to the same realization when we became producers. We didn't really understand what producers did. And that's just the truth.
Nobody does. I mean, even people in the business don't know, because it can mean so many different things. I mean, most of the job of a producer happens before the movie is actually shooting.
Well, I would argue with that. I do think that the best producers are the ones that can alter a project as it's being made.
Okay, but getting it to the finish line there, getting it to the point where a studio says, yes, we're going to spend $100 million on this. Like, that is a job that someone is shepherding that.
Yes. Well, and by the way, that's a lot of responsibility. And usually the lead producer is signing the contract that says I'm responsible for the $100 million or the $200 million. So, I don't believe that often the studio executive, if that's their point of view, they're just wrong, because what we do is has so many components to it that is not seen by them. And that's where I think the disconnect occurs, because we're doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes. We're, you know, we're managing egos, we're managing crisis, we're doing all this stuff. The idea that I think that comes out of what you're talking about is this idea that, well, an executive can be a producer. They simply don't have enough time. They can't possibly be a good executive if they're doing the producing. So I do think the best of studios, and when I say studios, I'm using it as a, you know, streamers, et cetera, they've come to see, or did see, the value in knowing that you can have faith that the producer is going to help them keep their jobs and do something from a quality management point of view. And you know, part of the issue that we're all facing, and one of the interesting things that we've found, Matt, as we've started talking about this, is that every studio, every network, everybody, agencies, everybody we've talked to, no one doesn't recognize the problem here with the proliferation of 24 credits on a movie that's $10 million. Like, how could possibly 24 people need to do that? I think that's what's one of the realizations we're coming to, is that, wow, okay, everybody sees the problem. Now, what's the solution? And that's not a simple, and nor do we think that we have all the answers. But what we're trying to do is start the dialogue and try to start it in a way that is, you know, in a way that we are colleagues with, and a lot of us go in and out of being executives to producers. So right. Our community is relatively small, and therefore, our belief is that this is something that is important to do. And honestly, this group didn't start this way. What started with was a group, small group of people bitching about the realities of what they're facing.
Oh, I heard this a year ago. I went to a dinner that Roy Lee, the producer, organized, and it was eye-opening to hear a lot of the concerns that ultimately manifested in this.
This episode is brought to you by Thomas's.
Thomas's presents Pondering the Bagel with Tom.
Oh, the paradox of the bagel. Tis crunchy yet soft. Tis filling yet has a hole. Tis a vehicle for spreads, but only travels from toaster to plate. Thomas's. Huzzah! A toast to breakfast.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
So, Kathy, tell us what you actually want here. What are you guys proposing in these meetings that you're doing with the studio heads?
Absolutely. And I was going to say, you know, we've been in these meetings with the studios and with the streamers, and they very quickly say, oh, we get it. You're the producer. This funny word that's come up. And they understand that, you know, there's the person that they need to depend on, and that what we're advocating for is that type of producer. We're calling it, Matt, a career producer.
Right.
And one of the easiest ways to understand what that is that person is only being paid for producing work product on the project.
Right. It's not a manager producer. Managers often become producers on their clients' projects. I should say my wife is a manager and she has produced with her clients. But there are others that come on to a project that are not what you guys call the career producers.
Yeah, the career producer is really the vision keeper of the project, and they're from beginning to end, and oftentimes the person who's originated it. And I think that's an important thing to underline, that, you know, most of the content does come from producers that studios and streamers make. They have some, you know, of their internal IP, but overall expansion efforts and content come from what producers originate. And that's, you know, a very, very crucial part of the process. So what we're advocating for is really two things that will allow career producers to continue and stop dropping out of the business or becoming, you know, kind of having to work on like side gigs like real estate and, I don't know, landscape design or whatever they're going to do. You know, but really the idea is to first and foremost provide healthcare for producers. It's a crazy, I think, irony that the people who are responsible for the health and welfare of the entire cast and crew are working without healthcare because it's not provided as a given by our employers. And so first and foremost, we want to keep everybody safe and have them make contributions. And it shouldn't be something that we have to negotiate for and feel like we've had a big win. Oh, great. Now I have health insurance for the 8 months that I'm making a movie. And in some places you can get it. Netflix has been a huge leader in this. They're really providing quite a lot of healthcare support, but there are other places that are doing absolutely not. So first and foremost, healthcare.
And you have said in the press release you put on Deadline, you said you want it for 8 weeks of pre-production, the span of production, and then at a minimum for the final 8 weeks of post-production. You want healthcare coverage for those areas.
That's right. And that helps us qualify for MPI insurance, which is available to us through a union, really. But we have to have a certain amount of hours to do it. We're asking the studios and streamers to provide either MPI insurance for career producers and or a contribution of a like-minded amount of money towards their chosen healthcare provider.
Okay, so what else do you guys want?
The second thing that we want is commencement wages. We're sort of abolishing the word, you know, development fees, because they were as Lorenzo said, that was established in 1971. It was $25,000. And if you simply did the inflation math on a typical government inflation site and plug in the numbers, that's $193,000 today. So we're certainly like long overdue for more than $25,000, which actually is $12,500. But in abolishing all of that, what we just want is pay for a fair day work, you know? So what we're saying is that we'd like a portion of our already existing fee that's been pre-negotiated at the point of this setup event to be paid during the development and early pre-production period of that movie or show that might take anything from 1 year to 13 years. And it amounts to 10% in film of the overall fee, or one episodic collective fee for the non-writing executive producers in television.
And just bringing that forward to be paid before it actually happens, which obviously the risk for the studio or the streamer is, if they ultimately decide not to go forward with the project, you've already been paid more than they would have had to pay otherwise.
In terms of the $25,000, yes, but it is an advance against your fee, number one. And there's been arguments about this because, look, we're coming up with what we think is a solution, and we have no doubt we're going to hear some alternative choices here.
Sure.
So I do think that yes, and if you're sitting in their chair, you know, one of the things that, honestly, maybe I'm a rose-colored lens guy a little bit, but we are a community, and it's, you know, they see the people that are struggling, and they see that. And so there's something that we do. We sign a contract when it's set up that every creative thing that we have contributed to the project, they own. And there's a lot of places that don't even pay you the development or commencement wage, in which case you're working for free, and they're gaining your IP, if you would, you know, right. Your contributions. And so that doesn't seem to me, that's not American. I mean, you know, I mean, to me, it's like, wait a second, you're working for free and they own it?
Well, you know, it is American, a union. And a lot of these demands or requests sound like union protections. The producers used to have a union a long time ago. The California Supreme Court actually invalidated a producers union because many members at the time also had stakes in the studios and they were deemed to be employers. Why don't you guys just try to unionize producers?
We're trying to do this quickly, and our presumption is starting a union would take quite a while.
Yeah, like Chris Moore and a couple others, they've tried to push for that, haven't they?
Yes, they have. And I think starting a union is something that, you know, we've discussed the idea, but our preference is not to go down that road. Our preference is to say, look, we are all in this business together. And we're here, frankly, you know, I'll speak about my own experience. You know, some of these Transformer movies are rather a lot of money. And the pressure of that is sitting on my chest the entire time. And I'm not looking for any tears from anybody.
You've survived Michael Bay how many times now?
Well, you know, I'll just say those things are hard. And this is one of the things that we are willing to say that we are saying is we recognize that some producers have gamed the system. And so we can't go to the buyers and say, you know, everybody's a pure, you know, they work hard, they do this, they do that, and they fulfill their function. Part of what we're trying to do is by establishing a terminology and a criteria for a career producer, we're creating a little bit more of a certainty for the buyer that there is some aspect of what they hope to get, they're going to get. And I think, speaking as a guy who used to put lists together of producers, you know, you'd always put together 10 producers and you'd cross out six immediately because either they cost so much in that point in time or they didn't show up. So that's a tricky thing because every producer does their job slightly differently. But what has contributed to that notion is that when you think about, as you mentioned, that how all these different producers get on and the fees keep getting split and split and split. Well, what that forces a producer to do is work on more than one project.
Right.
Because if they're not being remunerated in a way that they can afford to live their life, they're forced to bifurcate their attention.
Yeah, and I think there's a chicken and an egg situation there, right? Like the working on too many things and being distracted is an effect, not a cause, of not being paid during development and having to put so many balls in the air that you hope that some actual green lighting event will happen so that the payment can commence. And you don't control that particular thing either. It would be beneficial, and certainly our group of over 90 people agree that they'd like to do less all the time. People aren't trying to kill themselves, you know? They would like to be completely focused and to be more aligned, but without... That was accomplished by the studios in the past by making deals and partnership deals for producers they trusted. But without that, you know, sort of safety net, we have to work on a million different things and we don't want to.
And that's the answer to the question of why someone who's not in the business should care about this, because, you know, if you're listening and you are not in the industry, like, you could make the argument that producers working on so many projects to hopefully get something made ultimately leads to worse product in the end, because what you want is someone who cares very passionately about one project and sees it from beginning to end and makes it as great as possible.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, producing, I always look at it like, you know, it's so complicated to keep sometimes upwards of 1,000 people on track with one particular vision that you began with, you know, years before, and to have sort of the global overview to do that. And that is the job of the producer, while balancing the creative needs and the financial needs, to keep everybody on the same track and just sort of stay, you know, kind of in a diplomatic role, you know, above and beyond all of the sort of heady, you know, attention grabbing and things that goes on along the way. And when that's achieved, the movie is good. The movie is really good when there's an integrity to the process and it was well maintained the whole way through. And so there is a direct line between consistent producing and good quality content.
I would say that there's a higher percentage of possibility that it's going to be that, because
I'm not saying it's perfect all the time, but, you know, I was only speaking for you.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying, there's so many things that pull you apart. But one of my producing partners on Transformers, Mr. Spielberg, right after I'd made the movie Salt, he complimented me on the movie. And he said, you know, there's one thing about every good movie. And I said, what's that? I was thinking he was going to say a good director. He said, there's a dogged good producer, because they're the ones that have to keep going for year after year after year. And they understand the DNA in a way nobody else can understand it, because, you know, as we know, writers get replaced as well. So you don't have that continuity of vision. You have one person, hopefully, I say, trying to hold that DNA together. And that's where it also gets pulled apart when you have multiple producers, because, and again, we are not criticizing the manager, producer, the actor, producer, any of that. They have their values, et cetera. What we're just saying is there's one person who actually has to sign this contract, and that person has to have the authority to move a project forward in conjunction with the buyer.
And who would decide who is covered by this?
Usually the studio is the one that's saying, you're signing this piece of paper.
Right. So you would limit this protection to the one person on each film or TV project that is the quote unquote career producer.
Not necessarily. I mean, I would think that almost by definition, it means that one person is, but there will be another, you know, I partner with good friends of mine and they're really good producers and they may not be required to sign that. So it's really, you know, there is obviously a little elbow room in all
a
these.
A little, because a lot of these manager producers do a lot of work producing. Some of them are more producers than they are managers now.
And we understand that. And they're also getting income from another source. So what we're not saying, they shouldn't get paid.
Right.
What we're saying is, if they get paid, why are we getting paid less? Because right. Our job didn't change. You know, yes, we get help. Good. Thank you. Please come on in and help us.
All right. So I have heard that you guys have had constructive meetings with the studios and with the streamers. I've heard it has been very cordial. Everyone is understanding of your plight. But at the end of the day, their job is to reduce the cost of movies these days, not increase the cost. This would potentially increase the cost of movies. I wonder if this is all talk, and when push comes to shove, the studios are just going to say, you know what? Everybody is being squeezed these days. It's hard out there for every element of the movie and television equation. Why should we be throwing you guys a bone?
Well, what we're asking for right now, it doesn't increase costs, to be honest, because it's an advance. It only increases cost if there's an abandonment event during their development budget period.
Which does happen a lot, though.
It does.
That's right. Yeah,
we can't deny it's going to cost them something more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but one of the things is, when we did a rough estimate of what we're talking about from a healthcare point of view, for instance, it's a sliding scale anywhere from the high teens to 30 on a movie. So it's a little embarrassing when you look at it and say the caterers, who sometimes have it, but the caterers and the producers, the only two that don't have it on it, that are not provided, you know, and that does, to your earlier point about a union, the union has gotten those benefits. So that in itself doesn't seem like a particularly onerous ask. I think the commencement wages that Kathy described, there's lots of different ways to look at it. And no doubt some buyers will look at it exactly like you just described and say, you know, that's not a cost we want to take on. But at the same time, can they really look the people in the eye and say, this shouldn't have changed since 1971? So there may well be a middle ground here that, you know, we're not naive. We're not suggesting that they're suddenly going to sign off on our brilliant proposal.
Yeah.
They're going to have their own definitions of what they feel prepared to do. And what we're hoping is a lot of them are good friends and former colleagues and care about the health of the business. And, you know, as a former studio head, the thing we always noticed in our thing is every generation brings a new set of ideas. And if you don't have that new set of ideas, you're hurting the business.
I wonder what the leverage is here, though. Because as much as you are describing this as a cordial discussion, you, as producers, you know nobody does anything unless they have to. And the guilds have leverage. What is the leverage of a producers group like you? Could you guys refuse to work on projects? Could you, what do you have that the studios need that could help push this over the finish line?
Well, you know, I believe, and I think we all do, that certain studios are going to lean in and do this and lead. And we're already getting that kind of messaging. I think the leverage we have is that we'll prefer to work there.
Oh, because that's a good one. That's a good one. If Netflix hates producers, then you just say, okay, fine. Well, you know, we're going to send our best material over to the others that do work with us.
Which, by the way, has happened since I've been in the business, mm-hmm. is people know the studios or buyers, let's just call them the buyers,
yeah,
that are better to work for. They know. And so, like, I remember for years, you'd hear that this studio was last on the agency's list to give a project.
Right, right. Well, now I feel like it's no disrespect to your Transformers studio, but like the chaos at Paramount has got to put them way down on the list right now.
You know what? I'm on the inside and I'm seeing that business is going forward. So I try to convince people of that. And people have some skepticism, which of course you would when you read that. You know,
yeah.
What has happened is the multiplication of each project creates multiple phone calls, if nothing else. So suddenly, if you have 15 producers and you're an agent, you're getting 15 calls. Or if you're a studio executive, you don't have time for that. It's, by the way, so what's happening is everybody's time is getting sucked into this proliferation that is not the time they should be spending on making the movie better. And I think that will be a cause and effect if we can find a way to collectively address this.
Yeah, and there's certain people, for example, you know, Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi, who are longtime producers and now running, you know, Warner Brothers on the feature side. We've met with them and they had a very positive initial reaction to this because they absolutely understand what that is. And if Warner's becomes a leader in all of this, then boy, it'll be fun to work at Warner's.
All right. Well, it's a fascinating issue. I wish you guys luck in this. We'll be following it for sure. Thank you, Lorenzo and Kathy.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Matt.
All right, we're back with the call sheet. Craig, it's here. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Are you excited?
I've never seen the Planet of the Apes film.
I noticed a conspicuous non-response when I forwarded you the invite to the premiere of this one. Usually you'll be like, in or can't make it. This was a silence.
I don't deny they're good movies. I know people like them. I honestly get confused about the universe. All the titles are the same. The Matt Reeves movies are Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, War for the Planet of the Apes, and now this one is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes, Matt Reeves not involved. This is different from the trilogy of the 2010s. This is a quasi-reboot, although it's, I guess, a sequel to War for the Planet of the Apes, which was the 2017 movie. So it keeps some of that mythology, but it's got new people in it, none of whom are movie stars. It's all CGI apes. That's the appeal here. And the tracking for this one is about $50 million for the weekend. I think I'm going to take the over on this one. I think it's going to... I was burned by The Fall Guy, and maybe people are just not into movies this summer, but I'm going to take the over on $50 million. The last one opened to $56 million. The one before that opened to $72 million, and then the one before that was $54 million. So I got to think this is going to get to $50 million.
Yeah, that second film in the Matt Reeves franchise made over $700 million worldwide.
it's because the first one was actually good, and the goodwill then transferred over. And as Scott Mendelson noted, it did well in China, which will probably not be possible for this one. This is an international franchise, though. These movies do better overseas. But I still think people love apes, CGI monsters, so I'm going to take the over on this.
And that's why these movies keep getting longer, I guess, because people love apes. If you go through the Matt Reeves movies until now, the first one, 105 minutes, second one, 130 minutes, third one, 140 minutes, and now this one, 145 minutes.
Oh, really? My kid is not going to sit through that. All right, that's the show for today. I want to thank my guests, Lorenzo de Bonaventura and Kathy Schulman. I want to thank producer Craig Horlbeck, our editor Jesse Lopez, and I want to thank you. We will see you next week.